Good morning. May it please the court. I would like to address the five main areas in which defense counsel, trial counsel, was ineffective at trial and how those errors seriously prejudiced my client. Number one, and chief among those errors, was that she had within her knowledge information that the government's star witness had committed perjury before the grand jury in this very case. That perjury consisted of, when asked whether he had any prior record, he said, no, no. In addition, further misleading at the time was a statement by the police officer witness and also the prosecutor that if information to the contrary became available, it would be presented to the grand jury. That never was.
Well, what's the relevance of that part, that it wasn't presented to the grand jury?
That it wasn't presented to the grand jury?
Yeah, I mean, you're familiar with
those. It partly shows, it gets into the misconduct of the prosecutor who argues in his affidavit that this was just an oversight. In truth, he had an obligation. I am not, however, raising the validity of the indictment. My main point here is that that opened up a huge Pandora box that not only would have shown that this witness was a liar and lied in this very case, but it would also have opened up the Pandora's box where the convictions that otherwise did not come in as impeachable would now become relevant. Because in impeaching him and showing that he lied at the grand jury, she then becomes able to show that he's been convicted of burglary, a violent crime, larceny, a crime of honesty, destruction of property. I would also argue that it would further open up the door, especially in light of the government's argument, for his prior arrests for both gun possession and narcotics, of which he had multiple of those. Given the centrality of that witness to the government's case, I think that was essentially a home run that the defense attorney totally missed.
What's your response to the government's argument that even if you're right about that, there's really no prejudice here because of the magnitude of the government's case?
I would argue that the prejudice is critical, that it's almost hypocritical at this point for the government to say that, given that the prosecutor could not talk fast enough about how pure his witness was. The evidence was not overwhelming in this case. There was physical evidence. However, let's keep in mind that Lawrence Hart, the witness, maintained the premises. The drugs in this case were not found in the bedroom that Lawrence Hart identified as my client's bedroom. It was found in the common area of the house. Absent his testimony, there certainly could be doubt. I think more critically, once that witness gets impeached in such a serious fashion, and I think we have to note that this is a very different type of impeachment. It's not the type of impeachment that the trial lawyer attempted by saying he had a plea agreement. This went to the essence of his ability as a truth teller, and also in this case as to his motive to lie. I would argue that the other evidence is not overwhelming. They did have a statement of my client. However, they interpreted it as an admission that he was a drug seller. All he said, he was out there making money. I would submit there are plenty of people out there making money, shooting craps and committing other types of acts. Does not necessarily mean he was admitted to being a drug dealer, and even if he did, it certainly was not admission to the drugs in this case.
What about the fingerprint on the...
The fingerprint has, I would argue, limited value, although there was one match. That was a plate, a common household plate that was found in a common area of the house. I would note that five latent fingerprints were found on that. Only one was identified to my client. There was no evidence at all that the other prints were compared to anyone else or, for instance, to Mr. Hart. So, again, I would argue that that's not sufficient. I would remind the court that the standard here is not sufficiency of the evidence. The standard here is whether the court can still have confidence in this verdict. And my argument very strenuously is that a jury hearing that this witness had lied under oath and that the government ignored its obligation to inform the juries of that, and in fact went a step further and four times forcefully in its closing emphasized the purity of its witnesses. Not once, not twice, not three times, four times. And in fact, in his final words to the jury, what he said was, if you could find it possible that this man could possess this weapon, and he actually did a little show. He put the gun over his shoulder. This poor 50-year-old man, how could he possibly do something like this, vouching for his character in contradiction of what he knew, that this man was a convicted housebreaker, burglar, and had other prior bad acts. So this was not, as the government keeps saying, a minor slip of the tongue or a brief allusion. This was a constant beating of the drum that this man had such a high character that you have to believe him. And that was his final words to the jury. He said, if you could find that he did this crime, that's laughable. And in effect, what he also did by doing that was burden shifting. He was saying that if you believe this witness, and therefore you don't believe that he committed the crime, then Mr. Cassell must be guilty. That is not the standard. The standard is whether the elements were proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
Couldn't they both have been guilty?
I'm sorry?
Couldn't they both have been guilty?
The problem with that theory, Your Honor, is that this was not charged as a joint venture. It was not charged as a conspiracy. There's no aiding and abetting count involved. So therefore, on that theory, I would argue no, that under the instructions, there could not have been a joint venture conviction. The other point I'd like to get to that also emphasizes that she actually went even a step further in her ineffectiveness, because she not only didn't object to this burden shifting and witness vouching, but she also adopted it as her own. Her closing argument, in effect, concurred with his, that one of the two of them, if you didn't find that Hart had the drugs, then in effect you could find Mr. Cassell guilty. That, of course, is a misstatement of the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. To make all of this even worse, and I know the court covered this in its original appeal decision, but this is really a separate issue. On the 404B, that instruction was incorrect, because the instruction, the court had ruled that the evidence would come in on the issues of knowledge, possession, and intent. But instead, the court read an instruction whereby it said it comes in for identity, knowledge, and intent. By adding the identity element, the court, in effect, gave a propensity instruction. And given the amount of evidence that was introduced about prior gun possession, that was critically harmful to my client. Again, the trial attorney failed to object. And I mean, the government often says you have to take all this in context. That's entirely true. That's the real problem in this case. The whole context is that throughout the case, she made the errors of not using the evidence that was most valuable to her. In effect, it was.
Didn't the district court gave a propensity instruction. It's pretty clear.
Gave a propensity?
Yeah, it told the jury you can't use that evidence for that purpose.
But he did say that you can use it for the purpose of establishing identity within the very same instruction. At best, that becomes ambiguous. Mm-hmm. When you say it can be used for identity, identity is a very, very specific use, usually when you have a signature crime or something of that nature. I don't think we can expect the jury to pick through the ambiguity of that instruction. Again, the problem is.
Is your argument about the instruction ineffective assistance and failing to object?
Yes, she actually agreed to that instruction. The court asked them to submit joint instructions, and she actually agreed to that instruction. So, yes, that's clearly part of the ineffectiveness. I understand that on another level you've addressed the 404B issue. I'm not going there. I'm saying the instruction itself was defective.
I just didn't remember whether you had made the argument that way in the brief. If that's the way, as ineffectiveness rather than as error?
Yes, Your Honor. I think my entire brief went to that this all was part of the ineffectiveness. I mean, the government's misconduct being unobjected to by her contributed to the ineffectiveness. And on that basis, I would argue that we're using the reasonable.
What would the difference in the test be? I mean, on direct, we held that the instruction was all right and that it was okay to do this.
I think it's part of the ineffective, clearly.
Right, but on direct, the test was plain error and you had to prove prejudice. I know it wasn't you, but prejudice had to be proven in order to get on the second Strickland prong exactly the same. Actually, the cases are quite clear, particularly Murray versus Carrier, that you have to actually prove more prejudice than you would have to prove in the plain error. So why doesn't our previous decision foreclose this argument?
Because this is part and parcel of her ineffectiveness, and I would argue, therefore, he can't be held to that. I mean, furthermore, there is the issue that the trial attorney and the appellate attorney were effectively the same attorney. They were the FPD. That's
right,
why
but
I was
you're not. But the issue was, the issue of the appropriateness of the evidence was raised on the direct appeal, and we specifically upheld the admission.
I believe it was on a different argument, essentially that it shouldn't have been admitted at all under 404B, and that also she argued that it was 4043 should have applied. Now, you ruled against her, and obviously I respect that. But I'm saying this is a different issue. She failed to object to the instruction, not the admission itself, but the instruction, which is incorrect. That is the issue. And in light of all the other errors and the rest of this trial, that became very serious when they're arguing it's either one person's drugs or the other, and then to give, despite the warning, what really was a propensity instruction, the word identity had no business being in that instruction.
Did you have anything you wanted to say about the assault weapon?
I will defer to the court on that issue, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States. Your Honor, in this case, there was no basis to vacate Mr. Cassell's sentence. There was no prosecutorial misconduct, and there was no ineffective assistance of counsel in this case that would merit overturning Mr. Cassell's sentence.
How could it have been a tactical decision, as you say in the brief, not to confront Hart with the false statement of the grand jury?
Because you defend that
as a tactical decision. I'm trying to figure what tactic that might have been.
Well, as a tactical decision, Mr. Hart had said he had no prior criminal history in the grand jury.
Which was false, right?
That was false.
And
however,
this case depended a little bit on the credibility, maybe a lot, on the credibility of Hart.
It depended in part on the credibility of Hart, but even taking...
And showing that he lied to the grand jury would have undermined his credibility.
In some respect, it may have. However, it could still be a tactical decision not to do that based on the fact that the court had already ruled that the conviction was stale under 609B. The defense counsel would have had to go back and revisit that ruling with the judge, most likely, in order to ask the question in an impeachment framework in regard to the grand jury issue. In addition, it still was a 32 to 33-year-old conviction of a man for one arrest, property offenses, when he was approximately 18 years old. He had a 51-year-old man on the stand who was being very well cross-examined by the defense attorney on matters that were far more pertinent to the case at hand. And it could have still very easily been a tactical decision to decide.
On the convictions, that makes sense, but not on making a false statement just a few months before.
But I believe that the defense counsel could have been thinking, and we don't have an affidavit from her, obviously, but that this was going to look like a blip on the screen. If you have a 51-year-old man here who made a misstatement or a false statement about his prior conviction from 1967, she doesn't know why he made that statement, whether it was forgetfulness, whether or not perhaps that was a Youth Act conviction, or some reason that he may have had to think that he didn't have a prior criminal history. It's just not clear, and it certainly wouldn't have been clear to the defense counsel at that time that was necessarily going to be a particularly fruitful line of questioning, because she didn't know the reason why he had made the statement in the grand jury. He could have possibly explained it away for a number of reasons, which may have, in the fuller context of what was going on at trial, make it look like she was beating up on this 51-year-old man who, from 1967, had never had another conviction until the search warrant execution, and then who had not been arrested since 1972, and then had gone on to have gainful employment, buy a house, take in a nephew who didn't have a place to live, and so forth. And looking at the context of the defense counsel's whole performance, not crossing on that particular grand jury statement still was, it was a minor point in regard to the cross-examination. She crossed Hart very strenuously on the fact that he knew how to cook crack cocaine. He knew what was going on when the nephew was found in the house with a friend cooking cocaine. He knew what crack cocaine smelled like. He had his own electronic scale. He had large sums of money in his own bedroom. And she then parsed out his income versus his expenses. She spent a lot of time talking about his plea with the government and how that may affect his truthfulness and credibility during his testimony and so forth. And then she used those points and additional points in closing argument to be quite effective. She made all the points that I've just mentioned in closing and then went on to use the government's drug expert to bolster Mr. Cassell's case by saying, look, Mr. Hart's really the guilty party here. He has his own scale. He's got a gun in his bedroom. He's got ammunition in his bedroom. He has marijuana. He's got a large amount of money on him in his room in small denominations, just like a drug dealer would, and so forth. And she ultimately made the argument it was Mr. Hart selling drugs and selling guns out of the house. So when you take it in that context, while it may have been yet another road of impeachment, it was not the big smoking gun. It was not the home run that the defense counsel argues. And in any case, in this situation, the other evidence, regardless of Mr. Hart's testimony, was overwhelming. What we have here and what the government specifically focused on in the earliest parts of its closing argument was first the physical evidence. Every time, although the drugs were found in common areas, every time you have drugs, you have ammunition, you have some indicia of, the very strong indicia rather, that it was Mr. Hart's drugs. You have the items found on the table, the cocaine found on the table in the dining room was Mr. Hart's Sprint bill. There's ammunition with it. The plate that's found on the back porch with crack residue has Mr. Hart's thumbprint on it.
You mean Cassell?
I'm sorry, Mr. Cassell's thumbprint on it. Thank you. And has additional, the guns were found in Mr. Cassell's bedroom and so forth. And the government was saying that even that alone is enough to convict Mr. Cassell. But in addition, we had Mr. Cassell's statements to the police 6 weeks after the search warrant execution where he was arrested. And he said when he was talking to the police, he was questioned about whether or not his uncle would vouch for the fact that he was home on a particular day. And he said, I don't know, my uncle might say some bogus stuff. He's mad at me about the drugs and the guns, the federal stuff. And additionally talked about the fact that he, Mr. Cassell, went to Sursum Corda late at night to make his money. So that, taken with the physical evidence, again, showed strong evidence that he was the owner of the guns and the drugs. In addition, the defendant's own actions, as the government pointed out, were very strong indicia that he was the guilty party here. Mr. Cassell never returned to Mr. Hart's home after the search warrant was executed, despite the fact that his clothing, his VCR, his television, all his worldly possessions were at Mr. Hart's home. Once that search warrant was executed, he wasn't there at the time and he never returned. And in addition, the government pointed to the stipulations about the defendant's prior gun ownership to show that there was no mistake or lack of knowledge that he had guns in his room. And then after that, then the government turned and said, finally, there's Mr. Hart's testimony, and went through and parsed that testimony and so forth. So in that context, it's not ineffective assistance of counsel not to have cross-examined on that statement to the grand jury.
When was the conviction, the previous conviction of Hart? What year?
It was a 1997 conviction, and he was, I was thinking Mr. Cassell, a 1967 conviction.
And when was the arrest, his most recent arrest?
1972. And from then on, he had no arrests or anything else.
And was the question in the grand jury about a record, about convictions? What was the question?
He was asked whether or not, prior to his entering the plea agreement in this case, whether or not he had any prior criminal record. And he said, no, no. And then the questioning went on from that point on to other topics. In addition, the burden-shifting argument, it's clear here that the defense counsel didn't, or the government didn't shift a burden. The defense counsel in the trial had framed the issue of, you have two choices, these are Mr. Hart's guns and drugs, or these are Mr. Cassell's guns and drugs, and you have to find, really, based on the evidence, that it was Hart. Given that, the AUSA, in closing argument, was framing that same issue in the opposite way, saying they're Hart's or they are Cassell's, and you have to find that they're Cassell's. And based on the evidence, there's many reasons to believe that. So there was an improper burden shifting. In addition, certainly the defense counsel never accepted any shifted burden in this case. She strenuously argued in closing that the proper burden was on the government. You had to prove everything beyond reasonable doubt. And again, the court instructed in that same manner. So there's no prejudice here. And certainly the defense counsel didn't accept any sort of allegedly shifted burden. And furthermore, there wasn't any improper witness vouching by the government in the case. The defense counsel attacked Mr. Hart's credibility strenuously throughout trial, and based on Robinson and Monahan in this court, if the defense counsel attacks witness credibility during trial, it's perfectly appropriate for the government to address it in closing.
When did the government advise the defense of the prior record, or did they find it on their own?
It said that it was either on or shortly before December 4th, which would have been the day that the, I believe, the jury was selected. It was at the beginning
before
of trial.
Before the trial began.
Before trial began, yes. And in addition, just in regard to the 404B instruction, that instruction was proper. Even if the parties agreed to an identity instruction, adding identity to that instruction did not turn the 404B instruction into a propensity instruction. It would still be saying that you can use this 404B evidence for proper uses such as lack of mistake, knowledge, identity, and so forth, which are all proper uses under 404B. And the government, in particular, highlighted the fact in its closing arguments that it was using this prior gun evidence for lack of mistake and knowledge in regard to his possession of the gun.
Thank you.
If the court has no further questions.
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Does Mr. Seltzer have any time left? You can take a minute if you'd like it.
Thank you very much.
I think at the end of the day, what's most troubling about this case is that the defense counsel was clearly ineffective. There is no strategic reason for not impeaching. And contrary to what the government says, this did not require a new ruling under 609. Once she opened the door that he lied to grand jury, those convictions are coming in.
Well, can I ask about that? I don't understand. It seemed to me that the only way this works is on cross-examination, the question is, you were asked at the grand jury, did you have a previous record?
Correct.
Yes. You said you didn't, correct?
Yes.
In fact, you did, correct? Right. And he says yes. And that's the end of it. You don't get anything.
I don't think that's the end of it. I think at that point you get to complete the impeachment, certainly in the case of a man who perjured himself.
If the person says he did have a record, if the judge has already ruled that the record itself is out, you think you could get in the specifics of what offenses he was arrested for and convicted for 30 years ago?
I definitely think you could get in the convictions and arguably
arrest. You could get the content of the
convictions?
Yes. Can you tell me any case that would support that? Any case in any court that would support getting in the nature of the conviction when the only claim you're raising is the question of whether he lied before the grand jury?
It seems to me at that point to paint a complete picture, you're entitled to get in the nature of the convictions, not simply yes, because that doesn't explain it.
Well, you might not even want to get in the actually here.
Excuse
you might be better off just proving that he lied in the grand jury and had a prior criminal record. Actually bringing in that they're 30 years old doesn't help you too much.
On the other hand, the nature of the convictions is extremely valuable.
But getting in the fact that he lied does help you a lot.
I think that you're right. The nature of the convictions may be valuable, but I'd have to see a case where courts held that they must permit this. I don't think it's, at the best, it would be in the discretion of the district judge, and then we'd be speculating as to whether you got that information in.
I mean, I'd also point out that if one does look at 609, the age of the conviction is a general rule. There are exceptions. And it seems to me that this certainly then creates the exception because it shows that these convictions are still important to his truth-telling because he lied about them. And then the age of them becomes less important. If the court likes, I will, if the court can give me 10 days, I'd submit a case or on that point. I'd be glad to try to find that for you.
If you can have, do it in less than 10 days, I think that would be a lot. I'm sorry. You want to do it in the next day or so, Westlaw works incredibly fast. If you find one in the next day or so, that would be fine.
Okay. I was using trial court language of 10 days. I have till COB okay. on Monday, that'd be fine.
Oh, that's fine. COB on Monday is fine.
Mr. Seltzer, you were appointed by the court to represent Mr. Cassell.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we are grateful to you for your fine help.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to appear.
Thank you.